Tomorrow marks the 40th anniversary of what was officially called the Woodstock Music and Art Fair, billed as 3 days of peace and music, and took place on Max Yasgur's farm in Bethel, New York. Hundreds of thousands attended, and in the years since, millions more have claimed that they were there to skinny dip in Filippini Pond or witness The Who when they took the stage at 4 a.m. What began on Friday, August 15, 1969, at 5:07 p.m. with Richie Havens on acoustic guitar and ended early on Monday with Jimi Hendrix on electric was the result of months of hard labor and financial wrangling by Michael Lang and his partners. Michael Lang has written a book called The Road to Woodstock with Holly George Warren. It's published by Echo. And he is co-curator with Henry Diltz, who served as the festival's official photographer of an exhibit featuring never-before-seen photos along with some of Woodstock's most iconic images. That's at the Morrison Hotel Gallery at 313 Bowery. And I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Lang and Mr. Diltz to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Hello.
Nice to be here.
What do you think that it means, Michael, 40 years later, that 3 days, just 3 days, are still regarded as a or maybe the defining cultural moment of the 1960s?
It's amazing to me still. I mean, the amount of interest on the 40th anniversary exceeds anything that's come before it, it seems. And I think it may have to do with what's going on in the world today and the similarities between what went on in the 60s.
But it's also a monster that you created that you had no idea.
This
you
is true.
you say that for the past 40 years, Woodstock has been the elephant in the room of your life.
Yes, indeed. Very hard to get away from.
And why is that? Because of no matter what you do, people will say Woodstock when they hear your name?
Yeah, because it's such an iconic event and because I'm so closely associated with it and because I was in the film, I get recognized a lot and it's just every day I run into it in one way or another.
They even found a guy who looks like you for the Ang Lee film.
They did.
Taking Woodstock. And Richie Havens said in a recent article that everything in my life and so many others is attached to that train, the Woodstock train.
It seems true of many people that they mark their lives from that point.
Well, Henry, how important do you think the photos and the movie are or were in making Woodstock into that kind of defining event?
They brought it to, a lot to the whole generation, more than just the 500,000 people that were there. So certainly, they've helped a great deal. A lot of kids that were there, are very curious about it and want to know about it, of course.
Well, there are the really three big concerts that we associate with the time, Monterey, Woodstock, and Altamont. Mm-hmm. Two of them more successful than the third because of a tragedy. Now, Woodstock could have had the kind of tragic situation that we saw at Altamont, couldn't it?
I guess that could have happened, at any point, if we hadn't planned as well as we did. I think the problem with Altamont was not that it signaled the end of an era so much as a badly thought out and badly planned event.
Well, you're perhaps best known for being the man who organized Woodstock, but it wasn't your first foray into concert promoting.
No, I had done a festival which was inspired by Monterey in Miami a year before called Miami Pop at Gulfstream Park, and that was kind of the seed for Woodstock.
You also say that your initial idea came from weekly outdoor shows called the Saturday Standouts?
No, they were called Soundouts. And they took place on a little farm just outside of Woodstock. I'd moved there that summer. And it was just the best thing I'd ever experienced musically. I mean, being on a farm out under the stars, bucolic setting, listening to amazing music. Most of the talent was local, but we were in Woodstock. So locals, Van Morrison, and it's Blues Magoo, Ellen McElwain, Richie Havens. Amazing shows.
And well, Woodstock was known for all the music. Was that Bob Dylan lived there?
Yes,
the band had released their first album, Music from Big Pink, which was a house in Woodstock.
Yep.
Albert Grossman was just down the road in Bearsville. There was a recording studio there.
Not yet.
That came after
that
Woodstock?
That came after, yeah.
Now, but you said you moved there from Miami. You grew up in Bensonhurst.
Yes, I did. And I moved there from Coconut Grove. I had a head shop in Coconut Grove and then started producing concerts. And then
a head shop led automatically to producing concerts?
It was just a part of the culture that I was sort of immersed in at the time. And it did very directly lead to concerts because we promoted free concerts in the park at first. And then Rick O. Feldman, now O'Barry, and I produced the Miami Pop Festival together.
Because we had Fillmore, that was a theater. Mm-hmm. And the Beatles performed at Shea Stadium.
Yep.
Those all seem a lot more manageable than the sort of thing that you're talking about.
They were. I mean, the Miami Festival was manageable. It was at Gulfstream Park. It was a fixed facility. It rained like hell the second day, but still, you know, it was easier to deal with. But experiencing the sound outs in Woodstock really inspired that idea of coming out to the country away from, you know, our everyday lives and creating this space that we could own.
What were you doing, Henry? Were you specializing in photographing rock performers?
Well, yes, I had gone from a career as a folk singer in the early 60s to photographing all my friends who were Neil Young and Mama Cass and David Crosby and Stephen Stills. So I was doing album covers in L.A., and I'd just done the Crosby, Stills, Nash album cover sitting on the old couch. Mm-hmm. And I got a call one day from Chip Monk, my old pal from the folk days, you know, and he said, we're gonna have a huge concert out here this summer. In a couple of weeks, you ought to be out here. And I said, well, who do I talk to? And he said, well, I'll talk to the producer. And the next day, Michael called and said, Chip says we need you out here. So he sent me a ticket.
Well, I would have assumed that lots of photographers would have come to a concert like that.
Yeah, a lot of photographers did. But Henry in particular was someone that Chip thought would really capture it. And I wanted somebody out early enough to capture the build. And what went into putting it together. And so Henry came out well in advance to do that.
Now, you had, as you said, your original intention was to hold it in the real Woodstock.
Yes.
Because it was the home of that music scene. And also, I'm assuming, the politics of the town.
It wasn't so much the politics of the town. I was living there. It had a you know, thriving music scene. And really, the name really said what we wanted to say about the event. And unfortunately, we couldn't find any place big enough in Woodstock.
It was just that, because there had to be a lot of resistance everywhere to the idea of suddenly, whether it turned out to be as big as it did, it still was going to be a huge event. Yeah. A lot of people invading some of these small towns.
It's true. But the resistance in Woodstock took place after we decided we weren't going there. Nobody really knew about it until we started to look for sites beyond Woodstock. And we found a site in Wallkill, which is kind of the history, and wasn't ideal, but we settled on it because we were getting desperate and it was available, and worked there for several months, and then
that fell through.
The town turned completely against us, passed a law forbidding the festival.
And what were they afraid of? Just the invasion of hippies?
Yeah, they were afraid of all these, you know, freaks that were going to come up and rape their women and steal their cattle, and, you know, all the typical taboos of the era. There was a huge generation gap in the 60s. And people were very afraid of our generation.
Were any cattle stolen in Bethel?
No, they didn't produce quite the amount of milk they were supposed to cut in the following weeks, but none was stolen.
Now, Henry, how early in the whole process did you get involved?
A couple of weeks before. When I got there, they were just building this huge wooden deck, you know, at the base of this hill of green alfalfa. And it was very much like an aircraft carrier. It was just a huge deck of this brand new planks of lumber. And there were all these hippie carpenters, you know, with their shirts off and long hair, sawing and hammering and working like crazy. And, you know, that went on for a couple of weeks. And it was kind of like summer camp. I kind of forgot there was going to be a festival until a couple days before the festival. It was about 100 people sitting out on that hillside. I said, well, what the heck are they doing? Oh, yeah, that's right. There's going to be a festival.
Well, they showed up early.
They did. They did. And then the next day there were like a few thousand, and then the next day a few hundred thousand.
But you were there to witness the fact that this was a rather desperate last-minute kind of thing.
Yes.
Was there a feeling that it might not be completed in time?
No, not really. I think everyone was hoping for the best, yeah. You know, and working at full speed. And they almost made it.
We did. We got most of it done. We got the essentials done. And we worked 24/7, you know, the entire month to get it done.
Did you get any sleep?
Not very much, no.
My guest, Michael Lang, who with his partners Artie Kornfeld, John Roberts, and Joel Rosenman put together the Woodstock Music and Art Fair, now known, of course, as the Woodstock Festival. And he has written a memoir with Holly George Warren called The Road to Woodstock. Henry Diltz served as the festival's official photographer. And there's an exhibit that's opening tomorrow, is it?
Tonight.
Yeah. At the Morrison Hotel, they have a photo gallery there at 133 Bowery, is it?
Yeah, yes. The old CBGBs.
Mm-hmm. Well, then that's a nice kind of a link.
Yeah.
What was it like, Henry, going through all, did you go through all the old negatives?
For this show, yes, I did. In fact, There were some proof sheets that, or some negatives that had gotten lost somehow from the photo lab way back in 69. And very recently, Michael found some of the old proof sheets that we'd been missing. So we have those to draw on as well.
I've spoken to photographers who said going back to the old negatives, they often discover shots that they didn't think were any good at the time that now turn out to be the shots that they prefer. And the ones that they thought were really great now look a little cliched.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, the iconic ones stood out right away. But going back through them again and finding stuff, you know, being on the hog farm bus, going down to that pond, the skinny dip in the afternoon, you know, this was in the week before the festival. And, you know, just all the people on that bus and the little kids and stuff. That was very colorful. The hog farm, the commune from New Mexico that came to help out with the camping situation and then had a lot more to do with it, you know, the security and talking to the people that, you know, that had taken trips that they didn't know how to handle. And they had a lot to do with the success of it, I think.
Well, how do you book a festival like this, Michael? I mean, you bring people from all over the world in, some of the most famous performers, mm-hmm. some less than famous performers. You have to not only work out all the logistics, you have to convince them that they want to do this sort of thing.
You know, in the beginning, it was very hard to convince anybody, and we decided that we would book three of the major acts to let everybody know this was real. And once that happened and the word got out about what it was going to be and that it was really an event put on for the counterculture by the counterculture and it was the place to come to, everybody called us. We had very little trouble booking after that. There were a few acts that were difficult, but for the most part, we pretty much had our choice. And they were, in many cases, obvious choices. In some cases, like Santana, Joe Cocker, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, these were unknown bands at the time. And it's always gratifying to me that they went on to have major careers.
Others, I'm sure, who you were hoping for, like Bob Dylan, who lived in the town, or the Rolling Stones.
I didn't really ask the Rolling Stones.
But they were just too big?
They were too big. The name would have sort of swayed this into the Rolling Stones Festival, and that's not what we were interested in. This was about the people.
But you did have Janis Joplin, who was huge.
Amazing.
Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we will take a little break, and we'll come back with more from Michael Lang and Henry Diltz talking about Woodstock, just one day short of its 40th anniversary.
Amazing.
Stay with us. You know, there's something about a live performance. I think that sounds better than the original recording of Tommy.
Yeah, true. Different energy.
That's The Who performing at 4 a.m. as part of the Woodstock Music and Art Fair Festival in Bethel, New York at Max Yasgur's farm. With us, Michael Lang, who is the who with his partners Artie Kornfeld, John Roberts, and Joel Ruzzman put the whole thing together. He's written a book called The Road to Woodstock with Holly George Warren, published by Echo. And Henry Diltz is here. He photographed the whole thing as the festival's official photographer, although there were many other photographers there. I think pretty much all of the images that we associate with Woodstock, all of those iconic images, really came from Henry's camera. There's an exhibit that opens tonight at the Morrison Hotel Gallery at 313 Barry, with some never-before-seen shots along with some of the most iconic images. Well, why was The Who on at 4 o'clock in the morning? Were they not well-known enough, or did the thing just run too long?
No, they were very well-known, and we were delayed by lots of things, mostly weather-related.
There was a lot. There was rain, and people were getting shocks, weren't they?
Well, people backstage were getting shocks. Our trailers were rather shocking, but not so much on stage. But we had delays to dry the stage every time there was some rain and things got wet, and that's pushed everything back. The Who were scheduled to go on around midnight, and so on that night we were running about 4 hours late.
Yeah, for pretty much the first half of the book, you talk about the logistical struggles you and Woodstock Ventures went through to even bring this festival to fruition.
Yeah.
You had to fight the townspeople of Woodstock and then the next town. Then you had to secure Max Yasker's farm in the 11th hour. You nearly lost police security. Was there ever a point where you seriously doubted that the thing was going to happen?
Somehow I had faith that we would always somehow figure it out, and that kept me and pretty much everyone else moving toward our goal. And, you know, it seemed fated, really. We lost our site on the 14th of July in Wallkill with no options and no plan B. And by the 15th, the day later, we had found the perfect field, and we found Max Yasker.
Well, there's a film called Taking Woodstock that suggests that a desperate motel owner, the son of a desperate motel owner, was responsible for all of it. How accurate is that?
What's accurate is that he was responsible for bringing us there. He called and said he had a festival site and a permit, and we were wanted, and so we zoomed up there the next day.
And he had no idea that there was going to be a lot of resistance.
No.
And Bethel as well.
And frankly, you know, I mean, the film is charming, but it's mostly the story of what happens, you know, to Elliot and his family when we arrive. The truth of the matter is that Elliot brought us there, and then we found Max through a realtor. And the rest is sort of history, I guess.
And did Max look like Eugene Levy?
He looked exactly like Eugene Levy. And Eugene, it was scary how well he got Max's personality and character down. Max was an interesting guy. He was a Republican, very right-wing, very conservative, pro-Vietnam War, but unbelievably fair-minded. He certainly didn't believe you had to believe the way he did. And once he made a deal with us and really solidified our cause, when the town turned against him, he didn't waver for a second.
Well, you had imagined this as your standard festival where you'd sell tickets and people would come and they enjoy the festival. Instead, people started showing up days before.
Yes.
And they weren't going to pay anything.
Well, actually, that's not really that true. And there was nothing standard about the way we planned it, but we were going to sell tickets. And most of the people who showed up were looking for places to buy tickets. There were none. We never got the ticket booths in place. We had planned for people to come who didn't want to buy tickets. And if they didn't, there were free campgrounds and free kitchens and free stages. We wanted everybody to be able to be a part of it.
But you must have been really surprised by how many people started showing
Absolutely.
Up. And then there was no way you could have sold tickets.
That's right.
So I'm sure you've still made a nice little piece of change from the records and from the books and from the movie and all the rest. But I'm sure you originally thought you were going to pay the big nut initially.
Yes,
from
we weren't planning on losing $1.5 million. That's true.
How long before you started making some of the money back?
Well, our corporation exploded afterwards. Like, we weren't really mature enough to handle what we had in our hands. But I think it was about 10 years before it broke even. But pretty quickly afterwards, most of the money that was lost was made up from a sale of most of our rights to the film.
Did you ever think the Doors or Bob Dylan would perform at the festival?
I asked the Doors. And Jim was going through some pretty tough times then. It was after the Miami debacle, and he was paranoid. He thought he was going to be assassinated on stage if he came. And Dylan I never tried to book. I spent an afternoon with him a couple of weeks before the festival, invited him to come. I knew that he wouldn't want to be the name, you know, that drew the crowds. But I would have loved to have had him there. But
he could have been a surprise guest.
That's what I was hoping, but it didn't work out.
And then the Who and the Grateful Dead threatened to pull out.
They did.
You must have been going crazy.
We had
a lot of hair, but how much of it were you pulling out?
We had a lot to deal with. And you know, frankly, I love that stuff. I love, you know, solving problems and lots of moving parts. And the biggest disappointment for me, frankly, in terms of bookings was being turned down by Roy Rogers. Because I wanted Roy Rogers, I wanted Roy Rogers to close the festival with Happy Trails.
Oh, how great!
We grew up with him. You know, every Saturday morning, you know,
he was my
it.
Hero.
Yeah, exactly. And Happy Trails was, you know, sort of would have been the perfect close.
He might have been unlike Max Yasker as far as the politics was concerned.
He was very much like Max, only he didn't have the character.
So he said no. No
he
way.
He said no. Yeah.
Now, of course, the whole thing, as you said earlier, just has taken off over the years. And I'm sure you haven't had control of all the nostalgia stuff that's come out.
No.
But there's a new director's cut of the film of the concert, a remastered concert CD, and then, of course, there's Taking Woodstock.
Yeah. There's also a film that I produced with Barbara Koppel that she directed called Woodstock Now and Then. It's going to be on VH1 Friday night and History Channel on the 17th. And it's a great look back at, you know, what it meant then, what it means now, and she discovered some amazing characters.
Have you ever been able to duplicate? Well, you couldn't duplicate Woodstock, but you've done other festivals since.
I've done, you know, hundreds of shows since.
Well, there was a Woodstock 94 and a Woodstock 99, which I was a photographer of those as well, and they were great concerts. They were terrific.
But not a Woodstock 2009 40th anniversary. You had hoped to have one?
We thought about, you know, trying to put something together to coincide with Climate Week, which is at the end of September, and is sort of what leads to the Copenhagen meetings and hopefully some progress in terms of sustainability and climate control, to make that issue, you know, sort of more in the public eye. But it's a tough year for sponsors, and they had to be green, and they're struggling.
There are other people who were involved, like Wavy Gravy.
Yes, they were an essential part. He was then Hugh Romney. He wasn't named Wavy Gravy till he met B.B. King about 6 months after Woodstock. But that's a whole other story. But the Hog Farm were an essential part for us because we were bringing kids from the inner cities who had no experience in the country, no experience camping, and we needed a group that could help organize them and help them through the weekend and also to deal with free kitchens. And they had been a part of the acid tests, you know, in Ken Kesey's world in L.A. and knew how to deal with people who were not used to taking drugs and were having bad experiences. So they were the perfect group for us to set in motion this idea of communal living.
But that is a negative side of the festival. A lot of people had bad acid trips. There were some things that it just looked at times like people were returning to their infantile state.
There was some of that, this is true, but for the most part, I think those were handled really well because the Hog Farm had so much experience. And we had a trip stint where they take people in and just calm them down and get them through it. And it could have been a lot worse if there were, you know, sort of your typical outpatient treatment.
Now, we don't have Roy Rogers to go out with, but we do have Jimi Hendrix. And I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us. Talking about Woodstock on the day before its 40th anniversary. Some people have actually called the election of Barack Obama a Woodstock moment. So is this like Gate? It's like everything, Gate gets attached to things and Woodstock gets attached to things?
It seems. But if you look at the spirit in the crowd on that day, it's very much, you know, akin to what we were experiencing at Woodstock.
Mm-hmm.
A moment of hope.
And a moment of hope that, I guess, we hope it all works out, right?
We do.
Woodstock, in the end, turned out to be pretty good despite all the problems.
Yep, did.
And here you are smiling. And going through the pictures, I assume you were very happy to be reminded of some of the wonderful moments.
Oh, yes. It was wonderful to take that trip again through all of that.
My great thanks to Michael Lang, who is one of the, I guess, the man most associated with creating Woodstock. And Henry Diltz, the man who gave us most of the pictures that we associate with Woodstock. The book, The Road to Woodstock, from Echo, and also the exhibit at Morrison Hotel Gallery at 313 Bowery. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.